Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Of the hundreds of thousands of new books that come out in the United States every year, only a few make it onto one of those coveted spots on the New York Times bestsellers list. So, our next guest asked, what sets those books apart? How exactly does a book become a bestseller? And he used big data to try to answer those questions. Albert Laszlo Barabasi directs the Center for Complex Network Research at Northeastern University, and he analyzed more than 4,000 book titles that achieved bestseller status in the past decade. Hello, Laszlo.
It's a pleasure to be here, Callum.
So you looked at the data, a lot of data, and you came up with a kind of formula for what really makes a bestseller. And it's not just about compelling prose and a good plot. What did you find?
Well, actually, there's lots of factors that play a role, and it really depends on whether you're thinking about fiction or nonfiction, because different parameters play a role. One of the most fascinating things that, for me, really mattered a lot is that track record matters in fiction.
Mm. And the author's track record.
And actually, the fiction list is packed with authors who have been very previously many times New York Times bestsellers, and it's very hard to make it as a newbie. In nonfiction, it's a whole different story. In nonfiction, it's very rare to have repeat bestsellers, and somehow it's always a fresh face coming up. And it may have to do with the fact that in fiction, you learn a style and you learn a way of kind of writing as a reader, and you know that in the next book you will get over and over. However, if I write a book about success, and previously I wrote about networks, my network audience may or may not actually transfer the success one. Or if you want to write about Mediterranean diet, as your previous show was about, and now I decide to write about American football, my readers will not come with me.
I see. So I think my takeaway is that it's good to be James Patterson. I think that's really the message there.
He's a clockwork. He's totally amazing. Every 3 months a book and exactly the same number of readers from one book to the other one.
So if you are James Patterson, it probably doesn't matter what you write to some degree or when you put it out. People are going to buy it up because of that reputation. But for the first-time author, you've sort of devised almost a schedule on which it would be ideal to publish. What's the best time for a new author to try to break through?
Once again, it depends what's your goal, right? If your goal is to sell lots of copies and more people to read your book, then really sometimes October is the best release time because you're going to be ready for the Christmas when most of the books are purchased. However, it's a very tough time to get on the bestseller list because people are buying lots of books, so the threshold is very high. You need like 10,000 books to sell a week in order to get on the bestseller list.
Wow.
If your goal is to get on the bestseller list, forget October. Go for January to March, where there's hardly competition in that space, and with 3,000 copies a week, you can make the list.
So I know you have to sort of make this choice then, perhaps, between whether you want the bestseller status or you want to sell more copies. And you also broke down a possible choice authors might have to make between critical acclaim and making the bestsellers list, particularly in fiction, right? Those literary fiction novels that that the critics love and the press eats up don't always sell very well.
They don't. And they really, even though most of the talk is about those books, really, they represent a relatively small fraction of the books on the list. The vast majority are kind of thrillers and romance novels and kind of the trade fiction that really people buy in bulk.
You looked particularly at hardcover copies, right? Do you imagine the trend would hold true if we looked at paperback and ebooks?
We could have. We actually focus on the hardcover because that's when the book is first kind of introduced to the community. There are many examples of books that don't make it in the bestseller list and they make it in the hardcover, make it in the paperback. We have not focused in this study on that.
All right. So, Laszlo, you yourself have a new book out this year. It's called The Formula, The Universal Laws of Success. Did you follow your own advice? When did you publish?
Well, certainly. We published kind of early November, mainly because just to avoid the election season. And my goal personally was not to actually gain status of being a New York Times bestseller, but to actually get my ideas to as many people as possible. So we chose the fall time.
All right. So one of the industries that you tackle within the formula is the art world. And you come to what I think could either be an encouraging conclusion for people with little talent or a discouraging one for the truly talented. But either way, one of your conclusions was that talent isn't always a major factor in determining the success of artists. Explain that.
So one of the big questions that I'm struggling with in the formula is that what's the connection between performance and success? And if you're a runner, you are obviously, you know, your performance determines your success. But what's the difference between them? Performance is what you do, how fast you run, what you paint, what shows you put up in the radio. Success is about us. How do we relate? How do we acknowledge and eventually how you reward you for that performance? So your performance is about you, but your success is about us. It's a collective measure. So we learn in school that you have to have performance to succeed. And our research fully confirms that. The problem is that there are lots of people with high performance that are competing for success and not everyone gets it. So we try to understand the relationship between this. We look at sports, we look at academic research, we look at art. And art is particularly fascinating for us because performance is inherently impossible to measure.
It's subjective, right?
Is this microphone in front of me a working microphone or it's a work of art? Here, it's a microphone. If it's in MoMA, it's a work of art. Mm. So it really, what is art really depends on the context. You can't look at the object anymore and decide this is a valuable or not. It depends who did it, where it is, where was it before, and so on. So for us, art is fabulous because actually we can look at how success emerges without measurable performance. And of course, what we found in that case, that the key for success is the network. That is that we mapped out the network of how the artists move between institutions and galleries. And we find that the network that resulted, that connected the institutions, is hugely predictive of the artist's future. That if I know where an artist starts from, I can predict 20 years later what would be effectively sales price and what galleries will be willing to exhibit him.
Interesting. I want to touch on one other art form while I still have you, and this is a more musical form. Let me play just a little bit of Miles Davis' So What from his 1959 jazz album, Kind of Blue, and then I'll explain why we're here. So I wanted to play a little bit of Miles Davis, not only because it's a groovy tune, Laszlo, but because you used it as a good example of one of these universal laws of success you write about, which is, to quote you, while team success requires diversity and balance, a single individual will receive credit for the group's achievements. How does Kind of Blue exemplify that? I certainly just think of one person when I think of that album.
Sure. Let's step back and understand the fact that most of the creative work now happens in teams. That age where like a genius can come alone and alone achieve and change the world is more or less gone, both in science and in art. And so the question is really, what is a good team? Number one. And then once the teamwork has been achieved, and that's fabulous, who walks away with the credit? So Miles Davis is a beautiful example of what is a good functioning team. Because what the research shows is that depending whether the team wants to be creative or wants to perform a task that is well-defined, a very different organization works. Miles Davis is my example of a creative team, where what we're learning is that for a successful team to emerge in the creative space, you need to have a strong leader and lots of supporting role. If, however, you need to have a high-performance team that to achieve a certain task that is well-defined, what is the opposite is true. You have to have a uniform team with highly diverse, where everybody's paying attention, no one is leading, and everyone is chipping in. So, of course, Miles Davis and Kind of Blue is fascinating because it's the most released album in the jazz history, and we know exactly what Miles Davis has done and how he actually exercised his leadership and what was the composition of a team that really resulted in this high success.
I see. So if you had a band of six Miles Davises, it might sound good in theory, but might not work out so well.
That would be a kiss of death.
Well put. And that is Albert Laszlo Barabasi, a professor at Northeastern University, where he directs the Center for Complex Network Research. And his book is The Formula, The Universal Laws of Success. Laszlo, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Callum.